904. Who's this gentleman?
John.
Justin, do you know this guy?
He's fire, he actually left, because fire's meeting tomorrow morning, he's on his way.
Oh, so he's a little premature?
Yeah.
All right, so, obviously we're missing a few people. Connie isn't here, Bernie isn't here, Lee isn't here. And there's nobody from the public, so let's move on. Rose, I guess Atos is here, huh?
They're here. So I will go get them. I'll remind you, they are your head fund of funds manager. Been a bit concerned about their performance. If you look in my report, under tab 2, you can see their performance. On page 30. Now, we have two benchmarks for them, so we have the 90-day T-bill plus 5%, and we also have the HFOF multi-strategy, which is a hedge fund of funds multi-strategy, which is what they are, tier universe, median there. They are outperforming that, but they haven't outperformed the T-bill. They've been a little bit close, but they haven't outperformed that. If you do look at them versus the bonds, they are doing better than bonds over most periods, of course, a lot under equities. So they're just here to do a regular manager review, talk to them about that. They have reduced their fees a couple times, so their fees are down from what they used to be.
So since inception, I'm sorry, is only 4%, what are we expecting from them?
We'd like it around a 5% or 6%.
Okay.
Return.
And we have Southern doing it.
Correct. And their fees have come down a lot. As you remember, hedge funds are in the news a lot for charging 1% or 1.5%. Their fees are actually, they've reduced them down to 70 basis points, so 0.7%. So that's a lot cheaper. If they do get an incentive fee, you know, if they do well. So we'll just talk to them, see what they're doing, and ask them some questions.
Cool.
Okay, I'll go get them.
Bernie, how you doing this morning?
All right, how about you?
This is my last meeting. I decided I'm retired.
You gotta do what you gotta do.
It's inevitable anyway, right?
Yeah, it's either retire or die.
Well, but that's inevitable too.
Right. You know, you might not be able to do the other.
Mine is to screw the system and live as long as I can retired.
There you go. There you go.
How are you, Bernie?
All right, Rose, how about you?
Good, good.
Sorry, I made a grand entrance.
Rob? Bernie?
Thank you, Rob.
I'm sorry.
I guess he's insignificant, though.
Apparently. I'm sorry, Doug.
Hang on.
Bernie?
Doug.
Don?
Doug.
Doug.
Doug. Doug, good to meet you.
And you met Johnny?
Yes.
And you know Anthony or maybe?
Yeah. This is what happens when you get old.
You get these momentary brain farts, you know, it's a stall. It came back, you know.
What now, Frank and Bill?
So this is usually, well, they're in here in a second. This is usually in your book, but I had to make a couple tweaks to it, so I issued your book. It's usually on the back of your book.
So just so you know, since I'm leaving and Connie is not running again, Rob and Doug are city employees, and they're both on the old pension plan as well as the newer one, and they want to get involved.
So are they officially the...
They're officially voted in, I think in February meeting?
Yes.
Yeah. They will assume the positions.
So right now, they are...
They're just kind of shadowing, see what goes on, you know?
Don't be dismayed, guys.
Sounding as if...
Are they not ready?
Well, one was in the...
Oh, I got you.
Hopefully they didn't get lost.
So we didn't even notice Lee was gonna be late or anything?
I
morning.
Good morning.
We'll have you right here.
Okay.
Morning.
Yeah, you don't want to sit in that empty.
Yeah.
Pay for coffee and donuts.
Thank you, Patrick.
Yeah, I guess one of my colleagues, you know, I met yesterday with this set. We had sent them down in the past, but with the storm in the southeast, they never arrived.
They were in Orlando.
Rose, you get any snow?
No, we've got ice and my animals, I have animals that are very happy, so, yeah, it's a little bit just cold weather.
Yeah, but I'm sure you have a heated barn for that, huh?
Oh my gosh, no, I mean, I'm actually laying the cement in a couple of days, but...
Blankets for the horse?
No, I don't have horses like Ocala people have horses. They keep their horses real nice. Mine are just...
You just have an old nag?
Now, in Europe, the farmers used to live on the second floor. And the barn was underneath them. He would come up from the bottom, you know, ingenuity. They also had windows for ventilation that opened.
What's that?
Did that work with the AC?
So, typically 20-minute presentation, about 5 or 10 minutes for questions,
awesome.
And we may jump in as you go along. So, the floor is yours.
Terrific. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back here again. My name is Jim Hunselman. I'm responsible for the institutional client business at ATIS. And with me is Michael Klein, co-founder, co-president, and our chief risk officer. Michael's also a member of the investment committee. So we're delighted to be here this morning. Understand the 20-minute guidance on the prepared remarks. Please jump in with any questions or you can leave them to the end, whatever suits you. We thought we would divide the presentation into two parts. I'll start off with an update on the organization, on the business overall. I'll just give you a sense of business conditions for the firm as it's been a couple of years since we've been here. And then we'll get into a more detailed portfolio update. As part of that, look at performance through different time periods, the attribution of the returns that we generated for Ocala, some of the changes that we made to the portfolio, and then wrap up with comments on markets and some of the opportunities that we're positioning the portfolio to take advantage of as we look over the months and year ahead. So if that sounds like an okay roadmap, and I'll just check with you first. That's what the...
All right.
We wouldn't let him sit in your chair.
He said,
don't sit there.
How's everybody doing?
Great, thanks. Thank you. So if you turn over to page 4 of the book here, we're currently managing $11.3 billion of assets under management. That's up about $1 billion from when we were here last in August of 2016. And in fact, it's peak AUM for us as a firm, so we're very pleased about that. And what has, you know, been a relatively challenging environment for firms overall. Looking at 2018, we've had about $153 million of net inflows and continue to manage money exclusively for institutions, including a number of public pension plans such as yourselves. We're 35 people today. That's up a couple of people from when we were here last, and I'll talk a little bit more about that when we look at the chart laying out the team for you. And we remain an independent firm that's owned and managed by its employees. And that's a differentiating characteristic in today's marketplace, which has really been marked by consolidation, firms merging with one another. We're not distracted with working for a much larger organization, and it leaves us free to focus on our most important goal, which is generating the best risk-adjusted performance that we can for our clients. In July, we significantly broadened the partnership, making 7 new partners in the process. So there are 11 partners today out of those 35 employees. So getting close to a third of the company are equity owners in the business. If you flip over to page 5, this page lays out the different ways that we work with our clients. I'd focus you on the left box to begin with. That's the commingled and customized account business that Ocala has been a part of since 2008. The Aetos growth portfolio, which is the fund you're invested in, as you all know, now has a 17-year track record, which we're very proud of. The middle box here details an area of our business we refer to as co-investments. In short, that's investing client capital in a portfolio of best ideas that are shown to us by some of our highest conviction managers. And I mention that simply because we're in the process of raising a commingled product there to make that expertise more widely available to our clients. So a number of clients have elected to allocate a portion of their investment with us in that area. And it's something that we're talking to Siegel Marka, their research group, about. So it may be something that collectively decide you want to look at, you'll hear more about. And then finally, the box on the right are some of the other services that we make available to all of our clients.
Where are you seeing the growth?
In our business? Mm-hmm. I mean, the growth this year, the $153 million, which is a net number, we did a first close for the commingled co-investment fund, which brought in about $100 million.
Okay.
And then we've seen more of the growth on the separate account side of our business, more in the separate account customized portfolio side of things. We had marginal net outflows in the commingled business this year, which is not inconsistent with what many other firms have seen this year, but it's still about $1.8 billion of our assets, so it's still a very healthy component of our business mix, but very modest net outflows on the commingled side this year. On page 6, just gives you a flavor for the senior team at Aetos. We've had the two different greens here. The dark green lines are our investment committee members, of which Michael is one. We've had tremendous stability at the firm through time, very, very little turnover. On average, our senior team has worked at Aetos for over 15 years, which is pretty unusual in the business, and they bring a lot of experience, about 27 average years on the just financial market side and 20 years in hedge funds specifically. A couple of promotions just to highlight here, very significant ones for us. Andrew Walling and Jonathan Bishop on the investment committee were promoted this fall to co-deputy CIOs of the firm. They've been at the firm for 13 and 14 years respectively. They've made tremendous contributions, and we thought it was high time to recognize that and really formalize what has become pretty senior management positions for them as well, in addition to their responsibilities as investment professionals. The full team is on the next page, on page 7, and I mentioned we added a couple of people, other two analysts, as part of this chart, Eddie Bricolari and Ashley Chen. Eddie joined us from Deutsche Bank this summer, and Ashley came directly from the University of California at Berkeley. So we continue to invest in our investment team, and excited to have those two people. Really no other significant departures to report of any description since we were here last. On page 8, I just wanted to spend a moment on fees, because in addition to the 17-year track record that we bring to managing your money, one of the other important benefits of working with a firm like Aetos is it allows you to take advantage of the $11 billion we have under management, and in some cases the 25-year relationships we have with hedge funds, our CIO, Ann Cassell's time at Stanford University, where she was the CIO. She's known these managers for a long time. And those two factors have allowed us to exert pretty meaningful pressure, downward pressure on the fees that they're charging us to invest your capital. We've made a lot of progress over the last two or three years on that front. We've reduced fees on over 70% of the managers in the portfolio and over 50% of the assets in the portfolio. And you can see some of that on the chart here to the lower right. So on average, the average management fee is far from the 2% you read about in the headlines of the financial press. It's closer to 1.27 today, and on the incentive fee side, about 18% or so. Finally, just on the next page, and kind of addressing our own fees, this page lays out your investment through time with Atos. And it also shows you that we've reduced our fees three separate times on your behalf in 2015, again at the beginning of 2017, and then, as you may recall, we came back in the beginning of this year and reduced them again. We understand what's going on in the business. There is downward pressure on fees. We understand you're representing your stakeholders and want to, you know, pay as little for the best investment management services that you can. And so we're trying to do our part as well there. I think those compare pretty favorably. So I'll just pause there for a moment and see if there are any questions on any of that before turning over to Michael to talk more about the portfolio.
We talk about performance fees. Where do you decide that you're performing for us? I mean, since inception, you've been at 4%. So when do you say that you're to that point that you're performing well for us? Is that stated in the contract somewhere, Lee, or?
No.
No. So then I ask you, what do you call a benchmark point where you say, oh, we're performing?
Yeah, so thanks for that. That's a great question. And obviously, if you just switch ahead, I'll go a little bit out of order. You refer to page 13 and you look at some performance numbers. The role of this portfolio in your pension plan is to be kind of an anchor to Windbird. So it's to reduce the volatility of your portfolio, to provide downside protection, to have performance that's somewhere between stocks and bonds, with risk as measured by volatility and a standard deviation, closer to bonds than to stocks. Over our 17-year track record, and for pretty much all rolling five-year periods, with a little bit of exception over the last, you know, the last few years, what we have been able to do for you and for clients is to generate a relatively uncorrelated low beta return of about 4% over the risk-free rate, you know, over the Fed funds rate, over 3 months treasuries, okay? And when we first spoke to you just before the financial crisis, that's what we said we would do, between 4 and 5% over the risk-free rate. And as unpleasant as a ride as it may feel, and as unsatisfying, kind of like eating Chinese food, as these returns have been, you can see that we've basically done that. So if you look on page 13 on the top column for the City of Ocala plan, you know, we've been managing money for you for just about 10 years, and the average annual return is 4.27%. That includes the risk-free rate, which for most of that period has been zero. So back, you know, in the early 2000s, before the financial crisis, you know, most of us don't remember, certainly our kids don't remember, but interest rates were 5 or 6%, you know, short-term rates. So that clocked in at a very nice 10% return, which just felt better. That felt like going and getting a sundae after having, you know, Chinese dinner. And, you know, that, you know, as I said, felt much better. Mid-digit, single-digit returns, you know, are unsatisfied on one end, but not inconsistent with what we promised you. And then if you look at those 10-year numbers, you see that, in fact, we have performed between stocks and bonds, a little better than the Barclays ad, which is a mix of all fixed income. And it's been a great bull market for bonds, by the way, so to outperform that by some is great. And we've had about a little less than half the return of stocks in the CRI All Country World Index, which we can talk about the S&P, which is the U.S. stock market. This is the global stock market, of which the S&P is about 60%, and your portfolio is allocated about 60% to the U.S. and North America and 40% to the rest of the world. So if you want to compare to equities, that's the right way to look at it. Now, if you look at the bottom right corner of this graph, portfolio beta versus indices, you see 0.19. So the S&P 500 has a beta of 1 to the U.S. stock market. Okay, that's just that. We have a beta of, let's call it 0.2. So 1/5 of the return of the stock market, 20%. So if all we did was the minimum of doing our job, if the ACWI return, it says 9.75, just to make the math easier, let's call that 10, then on a beta adjusted basis, given our exposure to the market, at a minimum we should have earned 2% or 20% or 10%. Okay? But instead we earned a little over 4%. And I think you could think of that extra 2.25% as alpha. You know, that's the skill of the underlying managers that we select, as well as the portfolio construction about how we put those together. And what we've done is to do that with a risk of 4.26, or 4.25, whereas the risk of the stock market is 16.5. Okay, so let's call that with a third of the risk. And risk is just slightly higher than bonds, which are considered to be not very risky most of the time, right? So that's kind of what the numbers tell us. Now let's fast forward to where we are today. When we set up this meeting, we thought we were going to have a nice discussion about year-to-date performance through the third quarter, through September, when we were up 4%, the S&P was up 10%, ACWI was only down up about 5%, and bonds were negative. Barclays ag was negative. So we can kind of throw that out the window because October rolled around right at the beginning of the month, and it feels as though the markets woke up to the fact that, gosh, interest rates are going up. What are we supposed to do? That hasn't happened in a very long time. And in general, when interest rates goes up, the yield on treasury bills and other bonds, goes up. And on a relative basis, stocks seem less attractive than when interest rates are really low, because the yield on a bond paying an interest rate is pretty much a sure thing. And as I showed you here, stocks are not a sure thing. They're pretty volatile. Yeah, they can go up and down. So I'll talk about it a little bit more in a moment. But October and November and then into December, has been a very volatile and down period for stocks. In fact, whether it's the S&P or the All Countries Stock Index, stocks are down well more than 10% of where they were on September 30. As a result, as of Friday, and you need your race card to keep track of this now, there's so many races going on and they're over so fast, and the horse in the pole position fell back to fifth and so on. The S&P on Friday was down 1.5%. The World Stock Index down almost 7%. Bonds down almost 2%. Through Friday, your portfolio is flat. Okay, so that's what we do, is protect on the downside, lose a lot less money when these, you know, when markets are down. Markets haven't been down in 10 years, so, you know, more or less, one or two years, 2011 and so. So we tend to kind of forget that.
So do you have like a year-to-date number through?
That's year-to-date.
Year-to-date through Friday, I guess.
And you have to use estimates to do that because we don't really have a cut a net asset value until the end of the month. Mm-hmm. So we were flat through November. December has bounced around. So call it flat to down 10 or 15 basis points. So outperforming U.S. stock market, which has been, you know, winner all year, you know, for years, outperforming global stocks, outperforming bonds. Okay. So, I mean, you can't pay pension benefits with zero performance, but hopefully we're being helpful to preserving capital for the whole plan. And that's what we're trying to do. The thing about volatility is when you go up and down, up and down and down, every time your pension plan goes down 5%, you know, it takes more than 5% to get back to the level playing field where you were, so you got to earn that back plus, right? So that's the rule.
So I think we have some newer folks here, too. So if you could just maybe go through what you do. I mean, what is a hedge fund of funds portfolio? What does it contain? And then maybe how you pick those funds.
Absolutely.
Just on a basic level, yeah, and then you can get in more detail if you want to.
Sure, thanks. Okay, so if we turn to page 14, here's the characteristic of a portfolio. What we do is create portfolios comprised, in your case, of about 29 managers spread across that close to $2 billion who invest in a very hedged way in different parts of the market. There are three main food groups that we are allocated to in your portfolio currently. 40% are in managers who are called long-short equity managers. So they're like your typical long-only manager that invests in large cap U.S. stocks or small cap U.S. stocks or European stocks. What our managers do is that, but they're also able to invest short in stocks. So a popular short in our portfolio has been Tesla, given all of the issues that they've had and the high valuations. And in that case, the managers do the same research on companies that they do on the long side, say being long Amazon. But that research of, say, Tesla leads them to conclude that they think Tesla is going to go down in value. Same way with JCPenney, Sears, you know, other big box retailers that are coming under a lot of pressure, you know, given internet commerce and sales and things like that. So it gives them a chance to make money in more than one ways. But it also reduces their volatility because it reduces their market exposure. So if you look at the exposures in the bottom left, you see the bottom green line net is at 40%, which means that your typical long-only manager at Fidelity or T. Rowe Price, Legg Mason, Wellington, you know, would be 100% net exposure because they're 100% on the long side. Our managers, in average, and this number is higher because it includes non-equity strategies, but 140% long, 100% short for a net exposure of 40. That's part of one of the things that drives that beta number down to 0.2. Okay. Right. Then the next thing that we do is we take those three strategies, long-short equity, the second are arbitrage strategies, and the third are distressed credit strategies. Distressed credit strategies are bonds of lower investment grade companies, often that are going through bankruptcy or restructurings or have problems. So our managers buy those bonds really cheaply because of the stress that they're under. Par being a dollar, they'll buy them anywhere from 20 cents to 70 cents. And then they'll go through the work of going through a bankruptcy committee, a bankruptcy process in court, dealing with other creditors and manage, and the company and the shareholders to restructure the business, and then be able to sell that position after a year, 3 years worth of work, where they bought it at 30 and sell it for 70 or 80, you know, cents on the dollar. The business gets restructured, bad loans get flushed out, the equity people lose money, but the bondholders, you know, can make money. But arbitrage strategies are kind of similar, but they're a little bit different. There can be merger arbitrage, there can be fixed income arbitrage. There, what the managers do is take advantages of dislocations in the marketplace, anomalies, where things are being sold cheaply for non-economic reasons. So a great example of that would be that manager at T. Rowe Price, who invests in large U.S. you know, stocks. That manager wakes up in the morning and she finds out that a stock has become subject to a takeover offer by a bigger company. And let's say on Friday the stock was selling for $5. On Monday morning on the news of the takeover, that stock goes up to $7 because the offer for that, if the deal goes through, is $8. Now that T. Rowe Price manager has only one thing to do, sell that stock, make the $2 of profit. But the merger arbitrageur is the person who will buy that from the mutual fund, from T. Rowe, and do the work based on its analysis of knowing regulatory rules and whether that deal is going to close to earn that extra dollar. Plus, that merger arbitrage manager in our portfolio can do something that the T. Rowe Price manager can't do, which is to hedge that position by being long the acquired company and short the acquiring company, and therefore, if the deal falls through, minimize, you know, any loss that might occur. Fixed income arbitrage is all about taking two bonds with similar cash flows, but yet trade at different prices. So, for example, you could have a corporate bond that is in, everybody know what an ETF is? Exchange-traded funds, huge part of the market, and then they try to replicate, you know, a market. So a company could issue lots of debt, okay? But it has the same credit behind it oftentimes and pays a very similar dividend. In one case, one bond issued by a company could be in an ETF index, and because there's that extra demand for that bond, it trades rich. It's more expensive to buy than the equivalent bond that's not in the index that doesn't have as many natural buyers. So what a fixed income arbitrage manager will do is buy long the cheaper bond and hedge it by being short on the more expensive bond and earn that little spread and do that over a cross of things and earn 5-6%, you know, on a pretty good risk-adjusted basis. Those are your main strategies. Each one of them has 5 or 6 sub-strategies. And then, keeping that in mind, we develop a portfolio made up of managers who do different things. So we will be invested with managers who invest in different strategies. Within strategies, invest in different geographies, as you can see in the bottom right pie chart, and have an investment style of value versus growth, so that net-net, the sum is more than, or is greater than each of the parts, the aggregate of each of the parts. So you have a very diversified set of positions and exposures. When one thing goes down, something else elsewhere is going up. And that's what leads to kind of those smoother, less volatile returns than you see in a typical stock portfolio.
What's your turnover? Like, how much do you how many times, you know, a year do you sort of trade a manager in and out?
So we will turn over about 15% of the portfolio every year. Okay. Keeping in mind, you know, which is 3 or 4 names, right? keeping in mind that that's not the only changes that happen in the portfolio. A number of the managers in the portfolio have the ability and indeed the mission to move their allocations to where opportunities are. Say a event manager in arbitrage can move from merger arbitrage to restructurings to spin-offs to event equities and things like that. They can move from investing in a U.S. company to a Japanese company or U.K. company. So they can move where those opportunities are. So there's a fair amount, all of which we discuss with them and track very closely. So it's kind of like a duck in water. The duck may look very placid to us looking at, across the pond, but the feet are moving under the water that you can't see, and there's a fair amount of tweaking of the portfolios going on over time. But we do about 100 hours of work before investing with a manager, and then we're talking to the manager several times every month. We take a tremendous amount of data. We have proprietary technology risk systems that allow us to aggregate up all of this raw data so that one of the things that we bring to the table is having a very granular understanding of our clients' exposures in these portfolios and what the positions are, and if we need to make a change, we will, but we're monitoring the heck out of it anyway so that we know that we're getting what it is that we wanted to, what we wanted to get. So that's part of what we do. Are there any questions about the portfolio and what it's trying to do? Is that a helpful, Rose?
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I feel like you still gave me a benchmark of where you say you perform versus you don't.
Bill's plus four.
Plus four.
Mm-hmm.
And is that on a yearly average or a quarterly average?
So,
paid for performance. Well, let me just get down to the bottom line.
We receive a performance fee crystallized on an annual basis. We earn that fee on any profits over the risk-free rate. If in any year we underperform the risk-free rate, we have to make that up in the subsequent year before we can start earning performance fees again.
The Greek word ethos, how is that chosen as a company?
So in Greek, in aetos is a soaring eagle. And in Greek mythology, when one saw an aetos, which we pronounce aetos because we're American, it was a portent of good things to come.
And there's also a city named Aethos in Greece, so yes. I was just wondering if somebody had family there and they came up with the name. So the soaring eagle. Okay.
Yeah, soaring eagle, yes. We do have some Greek lineage in the firm, but not from the city.
So to Arnie's question, can you just get us the actual fees? The incentive fees that have been paid.
Absolutely.
Just give us the total since the inception, and maybe year by year, so we just can see them, what they are.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm bailing, but I'm trying to enlighten these guys as I leave. Because Rose will tell you, I've always beat up on fees and... it's like, how much do you spend to save what you have? And it's like, what does it cost us for that $7 million to stay stable?
Right.
And still earn 4%, what does it actually cost us? Because if it costs us more than 4%, it's not a good deal, is it?
Right. So, I mean, I think there are a couple of things going on there. One, the numbers, the 4% is net of every fee.
Right.
Right. Okay. So, the actual performance is the greater, you subtract out the fees, and you're ending up with the 4. The problem with fees, whether it's with your long-only managers or with, alternative managers like ourselves and other things that you may own, is that you don't mind paying those fees when the returns are really high because everybody's getting compensated.
Right.
But when you're in a low return environment, and by the way, regardless of what you own, everything is going to be low return going forward for a while, we believe. you know, then you're seeing, yeah, I'm getting this net return, but I'm also paying, you know, a lot in fees, you know,
right,
for it, right? And, you know, that's why, you know, we've done the things that we've done with the underlying manager fees, with reducing our fees proactively and voluntarily, you know, along the way. But it's a legitimate thing. But don't let your long-only managers, the Fidelities and the T. Rowe Prices, off the hook. This is a, what we do is a very actively managed strategy. We don't manage to a benchmark. If you're a large cap U.S. manager, there are 500 stocks in the S&P, you know, most mutual fund managers are going to own a lot of those stocks, right? So it's a, you know, it's a mix of 80% passive investing, which you can get for a basis point, and 20% for the active decisions to overweight or underweight a stock in the index, for which they're getting paid 50 basis points, you know, or, you know, whatever the number is, right? So if you multiply that 50 basis points to just the active part of the portfolio, that's a pretty big fee too, right? Okay? And then multiply our 70 basis points across, well, if you say a beta of 0.2, at least 80%, if not 100% being actively managed, those numbers can come more in line, if you will, if you will indulge me to kind of think about it that way. But all good points, you know, no question about it.
I think maybe just a couple more minutes to wrap up if you have any parting comments and then any other questions people might have. So.
Yeah, so rather than, I was prepared and certainly could talk about individual managers and positions and themes in the portfolio. Maybe that's digging a little bit too deep, and I'll just kind of conclude with more of a high level about where we are and where we might go, be going and what it means to the portfolio. So if you look on page 12, which is just in front of that performance page, this is a summary of many, many, many charts that we follow and produce every month called Market Conditions Update. I want you to take a good look at it and treat it like the Rolling Stones farewell tour. This is a good high-level look of where we've been the last 10 years. Market volatility, low. Equity correlations, well, they've been coming down and could stay that way. Look at stock and bond valuations. The green line is stock valuations, 30 times prospective earnings, and yield on the two-year below 3% again. Corporate spreads, health of the economy. All right, this is an interesting chart here for the total bond market and then for the high yield market. Remember, we don't really invest with managers who invest in investment grade other than in that arbitrage, which is a different investment. The gray diamond is the maximum since 2016 of how wide spreads are. The gold is the 10-year average, and the green is where we are now. So across the total market and across the junkiest junk bonds to other high yield, we are at historic low spreads. What does that mean? What that means is investors are getting paid very, very little to take the risk of owning the bonds of non-investment grade, you know, companies. And a lot of those are pretty historic levels, which means it's been a great environment to have market and capital appreciation on bonds, you know, as opposed to just the yield. But what it means is when you're being compensated for such little risk that you're probably about to turn over a cycle, you know, from an expansionary cycle to slower growth, and I don't know, I think consensus of economists are at some point in the next 24 months, some kind of a recession. This is the world we've been living in for the last 10 years. This is the world that, if you go back one page to 11, and you look at the S&P 500, and you look at the 10 years since the financial crisis, the average annual return of the S&P has been 12%. News alert, that is an astonishing number. Rose, the long-term average return of the S&P is a little more than half of that?
Yes.
Yeah. So when we came out of the financial crisis, the central banks started printing a lot of money, and they created a zero interest rate environment and very loose monetary policy all over the world. What were they doing? They were trying to reinflate the economy because Washington wasn't interested in fiscal policy, spending money, infrastructure, and things like that to boost the economy when it was so weak and in such a bad recession. So the central bank did it to pull us out of the recession, reinflate the economy through forcing everybody to buy riskier assets, to buy stocks. So it's a Fed put. The Federal Reserve, Central Bank in Europe, Japan, all did the same thing. And the consequence of that has been an amazing bull market. When you think of how much appreciation there's been in the stock market over the past decade, the 12-ish% we're down since October 1st, you know, is just a small fraction of, you know, of how much wealth has been created. But what does that mean going forward? They're, you know, the markets are very skittish, they're very volatile. There's a general sense of unease. People who, when the markets used to go down, people would buy the dips. It's not, you know, happening now. You know, well, why is that? Especially when the news is so good, especially in the U.S. GDP at over 3% this year, it's going to come in at 3% this year. Consumer spending, confidence, you know, really high. We've added 2.3 million jobs again this year. Unemployment is at 3.7%. You know, haven't seen that since the 60s. Wage growth starting, and so on and so forth. S&P earnings, the things that really should fundamentally drive how expensive the stock is. Earnings of the average company on the S&P is up 25% this year. You know, phenomenal. A lot of very strong economic signs. However, there are things in the other direction. Flattened yield curve. You're not getting paid more to buy a 30-year bond than you are a 10-year bond than a 3-year bond. Often a harbinger when the yield curve inverts or gets so flat that a recession is on the way. And then outside of the United States, growth is definitely slowing. But it's still positive. In Europe, China continues to slow down, but gradually, and it's been slowing down for a really long time. You know, but not a terrible environment, so why is all of this happening now? Well, I would posit that in the past, when we've had periods of economic expansion, the thing that typically drives that economic expansion is credit formation. Banks being willing to loan money to businesses to grow and to build stuff. As I mentioned earlier, this expansion has been a little bit different. It's been fueled by cheap money and zero interest rates, okay, which has led to, first and foremost, a really high stock market, and that wealth effect has, you know, caused growth to, you know, economic growth, you know, to follow suit. So it wouldn't be totally surprising for the unwind to be driven by financial markets as opposed to the underlying economy. And the risk that we have to really look at over the next year, 18 months, is a declining stock market taking away that wealth effect and causing confidence in the economy to slow, and therefore the economy itself slowing. Add to that a couple of things. One, we're on kind of a sugar high from the tax cut and the budget busting that Congress did last year. So that 25% earnings growth of the S&P, a lot of that is two things. One, the effect of the tax cuts, making companies a lot more profitable. The other thing is we happen to have a tariff problem, the trade war, all right, potentially coming down the pipe. Yeah, we got NAFTA, got to figure it out, maybe. Europe's got it okay for now. But we're going whole hog on China, which is the world's second largest economy. However that plays out, and as disruptive as that is, part of the earnings growth for corporate U.S. this year has been pulling forward sales of products and services in anticipation that they wanted to get it done before tariffs got imposed. So we borrowed a little bit of next year's corporate growth by pushing it, accelerating it into 2018. So what we want to do in conclusion with the portfolio is to continue to be allocated among all of these core areas, focus on things like fixed income arbitrage, idiosyncratic credit situations that are not really dependent on what the stock market does, try to stay away from interest rate sensitive sectors of the economy like housing. So we have a really, really good long short equity manager who focuses on real estate and has a concentrated portfolio. It has been a big disappointment this year. They've been long home builders like D.R. Horton and Lennar, and those, because even though the home sales have been, and new construction have been slowing, but okay, the interest rate sensitivity has really whacked those stocks. So we're just trying to stay away from that. And then to make sure that all of our equity exposure is very well hedged and try to be as non-directional as possible so that we can continue to provide that downside protection. I think that we're going to be able to navigate through this, but we are at an inflection point where the world that we have lived in for the past 10 years is about the world that we're going to be living in going forward, and it's going to be an adjustment. All of us with our own balance sheets at home are pretty similar to what the rest of corporate America and the corporate world and governments across the world have to deal with, which is remembering how we want to arrange our affairs when interest rates are 3.5%, inflation is over 2%, because that's just not how we've arranged our affairs over the past decade. So there's going to be some adjustment there. And I think we have a really talented set of managers and a well-diversified portfolio that can be all weather and weather, turbulence might be ahead.
Obviously, the picture that you paint is not favorable to the public pension system. The last crisis probably took out the public pension system. I don't want to prophesize anything, but my concern is that the next one may take it out in terms of if there are enormous equity losses. I think there'll just be a rebellion by corporate, by governmental sponsors of plans, it's crazy. I mean, it's absolutely crazy. And then my concern is, what's the next recovery going to look like? Will we have a 20-year bull market the next time around? And just a bigger, how much can you do in alternative investments to try to evaluate that situation?
That's right. Remember, on the other hand, that, in a world that has higher interest rates, even if the stock markets go sideways, your plan is going to benefit from, having that return component on the coupon on your fixed income. And if your spending rate is, what is it, 7.5?
Well, it's...
Or whatever it is, if you can put a bond portfolio together, say, beginning a year from now, that is yielding 4 or 5, I'm not saying that it's possible, but I'm not saying it will be, that will get you part of the way. More importantly, we do not see anything on the horizon that creates the same kind of systemic risk as subprime mortgages did in 2008 to, precipitate the high yield market going down 55%, the stock market going down, 35%. So where there are bubbles, they're not as systemic. They don't touch everything. They're more, more like localized. I mean, just for kicks, that you all know about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. Okay. Over the past year,
close to half a trillion dollars in cryptocurrencies. That's down 80% this year.
Oh, yeah.
But who feels that other than people who are crazy enough to get into that lottery? I'd rather go to the track. So that's an example of something that's not systemic, you know, as opposed to a nationwide overlending to unqualified buyers to keep the party going. But we all have a super, super tough job to meet our obligations to our retirees. There's no question about that.
Any questions at all?
I'm putting you in my bond fund bucket, though, a very depressing presentation. I don't usually bring bond managers in because they're always depressing. So now you've gotten stuck in my bucket of depressing.
Well, hopefully you can come back in a few quarters and prove us wrong.
And
prove us wrong. No, you know, we're really good at finding, you know, where there are opportunities, you know. We have a long-term manager who's up 17% this year, invested in things like software. You know, this whole thing is you used to buy, like, these software programs. Everything's moved to the cloud and is subscription-based. Those businesses are great. But now that everything's in the cloud, you know, cybersecurity and information security is huge. So we've got these companies that specialize in providing all of that secure internet security. They do great. You know, I was coming down here on the phone, and I'm running a little late on Christmas shopping on the plane. On my phone, I was using the Wi-Fi on JetBlue, and I was buying Christmas presents for my daughters on my phone. So all the companies that do the payment processing on mobile apps, you know, all those are have done really, really well. You know, energy has rebounded, even though oil is now down to about 50, but we've made, good money in energy. Biopharma. Immunotherapy drugs. There's one that's very promising for MS. There's another one that's in our portfolio that is a blood thinner and is the only FDA-approved drug that, in connection with the blood thinner, they've got another product that is an antidote to the bleeding part of blood thinner, like when you hit your head and have a brain bleed and that sort of thing. And that, you know, all of these things could be really revolutionary. They've made it pretty far down the pike. And as all of us who are on healthcare know, there's money to be made if you can come up with the right drug. Is that a little happier?
That's a little happier.
Any other questions?
You have to remember I have to present after you, so you just set the tone.
All right. Sorry.
That's okay. No, you're fine.
Well, have a great holiday, everybody, and thank you so much for your confidence with us over a long time. It's really, really meaningful to all of us.
Enjoy the bad weather when you have to.
It doesn't look like you're breaking out the gaming suit anytime soon.
I'll go up for a show or two.
Okay.
Today's news, my children are swimming in the pool. Ain't happening today.
Well, I will just throw out that was probably one of the best presentations in terms of just really talking about
everything, yeah.
Yes.
Bringing it all together.
How it all goes together. Remarkable for an attorney.
Yeah, I don't think he's practiced law in a very long time. But
Excellent.
And a little jargony, but I tried to.
Well, we need to be up to that jargon, obviously, where we are.
But wonderful. No, I think it's a good backdrop on what's happened, you know. So, if you want, we can go into
stage is all yours, Rose.
Okay.
Rose,
do you have an extra book?
Yes. Yeah, right here. So, welcome, new folks. So I'm excited that you'll be joining. Sad, we're going to miss Arnie and stuff, so. So typically I go over the quarterly book, A lot's happened in October and November and even in December. I'll talk briefly about that. I didn't really bring an update. Things are moving really, really fast. So we'll talk about it on more of a high level. If you look at our book, tab 1, page 1, we have a dedicated research group. Just a little background on Siegel for folks who don't know. So Siegel Marco Advisors is an independent investment consulting firm. Some of you know this, but independent investment consulting firm. And that means that we don't manage any money. We have no links to any money managers like the ones you saw here today. And the only way we make money is that we work with cities, states, pensions, union pensions, so that pay us a flat fee. So you pay us a flat fee on an annual basis. I think you pay us $50,000, $52,000. That's what you pay us. That's the only way we get paid. So clients pay us a flat fee. We have clients. I have about 10 clients that I service. Pay us a flat fee. That's how we get paid. So there's no, like, I don't get brokerage. I don't get, you know, nothing on Wall Street, any of those kind of things. We consult to $500 billion of assets. So we're pretty large. But we're employee-owned, so I'm a vice president. I own part of the company. We're employee-owned. We're a private-owned company. We're not traded on the stock market. And we were founded by an actuary firm, which you learn about actuaries, an actuary firm back in the 30s, and basically started there helping some unions in the 30s. If you know anything about the union environment back then, it was to help with benefits and to advise on what benefits they should offer union employees back then. That's the generation of the company. We did that till 1969. We founded the investment arm of that, which is Siegel Marco Advisors. And that's what we've been doing since. And I work, Siegel itself is probably 50 or 60% union pension plans, and then 30% public pension plans. My book of what I work with is about 70 or 80% public pension plans. So I work for the city of Tallahassee up there. I work for Cape Coral General Employees. I do some work down in Broward County. So I have a lot of Florida public pension plans, and then I do some in Tennessee where I live, and some in D.C. I do some unions in D.C. So that's where I am. Just a little background on me, and I've been doing this with Siegel for 18 years. I've been there. So, but tab one, that's to say tab one, page one, these are our research group. We have a dedicated research group because our job is to scour the market and find you the best money managers that can manage your money. That's what we're doing. So we're helping you find the best asset allocation, where to put your money in what buckets, and then what managers to manage. So from a high level, you can think of us, if you're a baseball person, as the manager of the team, right? We're the manager of the team. So I don't manage any, I don't do any of the actual work, I guess, per se, you know, the hitting of the balls or anything, but I manage your people on your team, right? So I'm saying, take this guy in, pull this guy out, put this guy in, that kind of thing. And so that's what I'm doing. You can think of me as a manager of a baseball team. And to back me up, to find those, I have a research team. That's all they do. They're scouring and looking for the best managers to manage your money. And then they give them to me, and then I give them to you in the buckets that you need them to go in. And then they also, on a quarterly basis, put these market conditions, and they go in your book every quarter. And they have a webinar that you can get on. I think Arnie may have done it once or twice. You get on there, and you can listen to my research group go through these. Because I will put you to sleep if I go through every page in here, and I'm not going to. I'll hit a couple of highlights. But if you wanted to go into depth, financial depth, you could get on the phone with them. So as of September, page one, we actually had good markets through September. U.S. equities was up 7% through September. That's that second bar there. 17.6% for the year. You hoard them through Friday, basically washed all that away. Okay? Markets been up and down and all around. October was negative. November was actually positive for the S&P, and December has been a disaster. But we're here to talk about September. We're going to talk about that. I can answer questions about the other months. Bonds were negative. We had expected bonds to be negative. We've been diversifying out of bonds because we knew as interest rates went up, we wouldn't have the bond returns. Real estate has done well, private equity has done well, and hedge funds has done okay. You've increased your amount of real estate, which has done very well for you. You've done things in the portfolio to try to mitigate some of these losses. If you flip to page 2, what he was talking about, 10-year return on the S&P 500 U.S. equities is 12%. That's a high return. We expect U.S. equities going forward to do about 8%. So if you think about that in your brain, if the last 10 years they've done 12, we expect them going forward to only do 8, then there's probably some imbalance there, right? And then if you look at the non-U.S. markets, we expect them to do about 7 to 8 too, so they're at 5. So you could see where we think maybe places would come up and places would maybe come down, right? If we're thinking, I was a math major, so excuse me a little bit, but a reversion to a mean, which we call it, right? The average over a long period of time. If you're above that, we're probably going to come down, which is what he was talking about, the U.S. equity market. If you're below that, we expect you to probably come up to the average, right, over time. You can see real estate there, 10 years, about 5%. More recent periods have done well. We think that there's still, even though interest rates are increasing, you're still going to see, especially in the managers you have, doing well in real estate. Emerging markets have been a very tough place to be with China and trade and those kind of things. Just a little bit about bonds, just page 10. You know, he talked about the yield curve. Top of page 10 really shows you what has happened in the yield curve. So as the Fed, maybe even though Fed has increased interest rates, you know, if you get a mortgage now, it's a lot more expensive than it was 2 or 3 years ago to get a mortgage. And the reason that it is because the Fed has been increasing rates. If you look at that blue line, that's what it was as of 2 years ago, basically. And the green line at the top is what it is now. So you can see a very large 2%, almost 2% jump in rates. But the long end of the rate, the 30-year, hasn't really moved. And that's what they mean by flattening of the yield curve. It flattens out as the short term comes up and if the long term doesn't go up, right? So that's what's been happening. And page 11 is the results of that. What are the results? You got fixed income returns in the negative areas for the 1 year. 3 year, 5 year, 10 year returns, okay, but you can see the shorter run is affected by the Fed increasing the rates. Every quarter they put noteworthy developments in here. I was actually just with your actuary last week, Doug, and there's an actuary chart in here, so I told him he needed to take the actuary chart with him, but pages 18, 19, and 20 are noteworthy. These change every quarter. The other stuff in here doesn't change. So if you're looking for inflation, GDP, those numbers, they're always in here from quarter to quarter. But these pages change. So page 18 talks a little bit about emerging markets and about when there's a real down on emerging markets, then it pops back up, right? So just sort of telling people to hang in there a little bit with emerging markets. Page 19 actually says, you know, those mortality tables they were talking to you about made you adopt, and Florida has this one you have to have. Well, actually, more people have died than they expected, which actually has been good for pensions. I know it sounds terrible, but it's actually been good for pensions and added to their, you know, money you have when you estimate deaths to be one thing and then you achieve more. It's actually
so they're going to lower mortality numbers.
I don't think they're going to touch the mortality table, but you'll see an experience like he talks about experience gains. You'll see the experience.
I guess
gains.
They feel the opioid crisis is
killing off the
week.
It's okay. Kill off the week.
Yeah.
Page 20 is the e-commerce bubble. As you might have heard. Talked in the news that if the S&P 500 didn't include Facebook, Amazon, what they call the FANG stocks, Netflix, right. Those, it wouldn't have done very well. And now it's, you know, negative. Those stocks have been really pulling the S&P 500. And so is there an e-commerce bubble that sort of talks about that? We'll get into your performance, your numbers, which are under tab 2, page 22. This page is as much to tell you how much money you have is to also be a compliance chart. So most people don't realize this. We do it like once every 3 or 4 years when we change the asset allocation, but you have policy guidelines that you have to follow. I help develop those as part of my job too, is your policy guidelines. And on the left-hand side, those are your targets. That's actually what's in your policy. It says you have to have these targets to these asset classes. And then the very far right are your ranges. You can't go outside these ranges. So I'm always here on a quarterly basis to say, are we at our targets? Are we below or above? You're never going to be exactly on, which is fine, but do we need to rebalance? Should we take some money from one place and put it somewhere else? You haven't been in a place where you need to rebalance, and I still don't think that you're at a place where you need to rebalance. Your target to large cap is 14, you're at 16. Your target to small is at 6, you're at 7.82. So you're a little bit over there. Again, that has probably corrected in the last month or two, right? On its own a little bit. International equity, your target's at 22, you're at 21.5, basically. So your target to equity is 42, you're at 46. So you're about 4% over, not a huge amount. The market's adjusted a little bit, you're probably closer now. Your fixed income target's at 32, you're at 27, so you're under by about 4.5. Now, as you remember, real estate, your target's at 12.5, and you're at 12. So last meeting, you voted some new real estate managers, because a lot of these real estate managers, real estate's a little bit different than your other asset classes. So your other asset classes, you give HOs money, you give it to them, and they invest it. Real estate, you say, hey, I want to give you $4 million. Well, the real estate manager says, and this is called value add and opportunistic real estate. So this is sort of what it looks like, right? So here's core real estate. Here's value add, my ugly chart. And here is what we call opportunistic. And then basically here, this would be returns, right? And then this is risk, right? So core real estate is like A properties in A cities, like in New York City and Boston and California, right? And they buy them, and they buy them for what they cost, right? And the appreciation is not going to be much. I mean, it's the same building it's going to cost, but you get income off it. It's 99% leased, and you're just doing it to almost like clip a coupon like bonds used to be back in the day. You just clip, and you get 4 or 5%. You're just getting income. So that's what core is, core properties. There's nothing major is going to happen. You might have to fix a thing or two, but these are properties that aren't very old usually. They're really A properties. What would they call A properties? Value add is like B properties, right? There's a little bit wrong with them, not less. They may be 70% leased or 80% leased. You may need to come in and fix kitchens, or you may need to fix the yard, or you may need to whatever it is. And when we're talking properties, we're talking about apartments, but we're also talking about maybe office space, right, and all the different property types. And then opportunistic could be anything, right? We go in, maybe there's no tenants. Maybe it's a mall. We need to totally reconfigure it, right, and put some hospital, which they're doing in malls now, put some hospital stuff in there to get foot traffic to the mall, put a bowling alley in, they need to redo it. Buying property and just developing the building, right, that's opportunistic. So your real estate that you have in this portfolio is core, value add, and opportunistic. We put different managers together so you get the whole spectrum of real estate. If we put you all in opportunistic, that would be too risky, right? So we have to put you in all the property types. The value add and opportunistic ideas, you say, I'm going to give you $4 million. Well, they don't take it right away. They say, okay, you committed $4 million, that's great. As we find the properties, we're going to call that money. And they can never call more than the $4 million, but over a three-year period, they're going to call that money down. Then they're going to invest in those properties, fix them, you know, and then sell them, right? So for the first 3 years, you give them money. For the next 3 or 4 years, they fix up the properties. For the next 3 or 4 years, they give you the money back. And then the fund is over. Then you have your money, and then you got to do it again, right? So if you look here where it says commitment, that's the amount of money you said you were going to give them. What contributed is the amount of money you actually gave them. And sometimes they don't call your full $3 million. It depends on what properties that they find. And then distributed is the money that they've given back to you. So we always have to be conscious. We've just done this. Last meeting, we interviewed real estate managers. We interviewed Long Wharf and Dune. The vote was to give Long Wharf $4 million and Dune $4 million. Long Wharf, I think we're fine with contract-wise. The Dune contract, we couldn't get a legal contract because they, you know, they just didn't want to agree to what you needed, which is fine. That sometimes happens. And I always tell clients that, you know, if you can't get a legal agreement, it doesn't matter. I have plenty of people to pick from. Don't feel bad if for some reason, sometimes what happens is that people are in Wall Street and then we're here, right? And so people in Wall Street have sometimes a fancy idea of what they think they can do or, you know, get people to sign for legal contracts. And then, you know, we don't want to necessarily agree to, you know, sell our first child to them, you know, just so they take our money, right? We're not going to do that. So that sometimes happens. People have a attitude that's maybe not, I try never to bring those people to you, but sometimes it happens through the legal process that they want things that we can't agree to. That sort of happened.
Primarily, the two of the problems with June was our sunshine laws here and our public records laws.
They think they have secrets. I don't think they really have secrets, but they think they have secrets, yeah. And they don't want people to know.
They don't want people to know how they lose everybody's money.
Yeah. I mean, they've been a good manager, and they've done very, very well, and they're a good manager. It's just, again, it's the difference between working in public funds, which I work in all the time. I've been in newspapers. I've been in front of city council. I've been broadcast on TV. So I understand when I meet in front of you, everything is public. And if any manager calls me, I know everything's public. I will tell them that. They don't always listen. And I think this was one manager who didn't really listen to me when I said, what you do and say here will be public. And that's their loss, not your loss, really. So again, you have a lot of this money coming back to you, even though you're at your 12%, 12.5%. You're not far from it. You have a lot of this money coming back to you. So if you look there, Long Wharf 5, that money, that 2.6 will come back to you. Penn Square is going to come back to you soon. The $2 million from Colony is coming back to you. The $2 million from Town Square is coming back to you. And then this Westport 1.9 is coming back to you. The newer fund, Westport 2, they're still drawing money. And then Long Wharf will draw money. My suggestion would just to be give Long Wharf more money. So you decide to give them $8 million commitment. I would recommend that you give them $4 million. I would recommend that you give them $8 million, which would be the total. If you don't want to do that, I could bring more real estate managers, but I don't think that that's necessary. So your alternatives target's 13.5. You're at 11.7, so you're fine there, and then you have residual amounts of cash. Total value as of 9/30 is $152,200,000. And $12,497. So I don't know if you want to talk about the Dune issue now.
So Dune is dead, so I think we just need a motion to move the money somewhere else. Long Wharf has been good, but chair can't make a nomination. And second, he can't make a nomination.
He can ask for
a motion. I can ask somebody and talk them through it and work them through it. Ernie and I have always done that pretty well, but I'd be happy to show you the Robert's Rule Book if you want. I just try to stay where I should be as far as, you know, running a meeting and keeping it going, but Ernie, your thoughts about moving some money to Long Wharf? Are you moving the money there, Johnny?
So I'll make a motion to take Rosa's recommendation to add $4 million to Long Wharf.
So make it from $4 million commit to $8 million.
Second.
All those four? Aye.
We have a second.
Yeah, Dan has a second. All those four?
Aye.
Four of us? Aye.
Okay. So now we'll move on to performance. So that's page 30. And so your total fund performance is how the whole fund has done as of each time period. And what we try to do is say, if every single manager that you had invested in an index, a lot of times there's an index out there. Not all your people have great indexes, because real estate, it's hard to get an index for all of that. What I showed you, core, value, average, it's not a great index always. But if we able to put all the money in just an index fund at really cheap fees, what would that do? And hopefully, all the people I've put together are outperforming that, right? That's what I want to do. So if you look at the top line there on page 30, for the quarter we did 1.94 versus 1.85, so we outperformed for the quarter. For year-to-date, we're under a little bit, 1.76 versus the 1.88, and we're under a little bit for the 1 year, right? For the three-year, we outperform, so we're out on the three-year, under a little bit five-year, under a little bit seven-year, outperforming 10-year in since inception. And since inception, you're outperforming by over a percent, which is great to be able to do that year-over-year, outperform the market. That's what you're doing. You're outperforming the market. And so, you know, that just says we put everybody together in a way where we could outperform what the market did, which is getting more and more difficult to do. My job has increasingly got more difficult over the last 18 years. Usually when you're at a job a while, it gets easier, but more and more difficult. So these are your managers. Like I sort of said, if you're on a your baseball manager, these are your lineup. These are your players, right? These are your players. So Wedge Capital is managing large cap value. You can see that by the index. It's Russell 1000 value. That's what they're managing for you. And if you look across the board, they've outperformed over every single period. It doesn't always happen every single period. I think maybe a year or two ago, we were here and Wedge was under a little bit. You know, they go back and forth, but a really good manager, over the long run, they're going to be outperforming. And that's what they're doing here, and they're doing it over all periods, which is great. Wellington, under a little bit there for the quarter, outperforming year to date. This is a manager we've been watching a little bit because they did have some underperformance. They've come back this year, so it's nice to see them coming back, but still under on the three-year and the five-year period. So we'll continue to watch them. We like Wellington. Our research group, when they're looking for the best managers for you, they do this, what they call a seven-factor approach. And Arnie's been to our conference, and Bernie's been to our conference, so they know a little bit about how this works. But only one of those factors is performance, right? And you're like, well, why is that? Is it performance the most important thing? Performance is the most important thing once you have it, or, you know, was there a manager for you? But just because somebody did well, and you all hear this disclosure, past performance, not an indication of future performance, but just because a manager did well historically, doesn't mean they're going to do well for you. And all that matters is if they're going to do well for you. All that matters is if they're going to do well in the future, which is a really hard thing to predict. But we've gotten these seven factors down, and we've been able to prove it to ourselves through the math we've done to look at the managers that we've picked and to see if our picks actually do well, right? But that if these seven factors are there, performance being one of them, but organization, stable team, stable philosophy, fees, the people, the organ, you know, if they're employee owned or not, how they're structured, how they actually manage the money, those kind of things. If those are all in place, we think those managers will be the managers that outperform other people going forward. And that's what we're there to pick for you. So they don't always perform, as you can see, this Wellington, they may have been out of favor a little bit, their style out of favor over the last 3 or 5 years, but we still think they're a strong manager. We still think that they're going to do well for you going forward. Siegel Bryant Hamill, and they were on watch list for a little while, and you could see that by the long-term number, they're still under by about 10 basis points since inception. But if you look at the more recent performance, look at this, 8% versus a 4 for the quarter. Year-to-date, they're really good. 1 year, they're overperforming. And small cap asset class, this is Russell 2000, that small cap, can be really volatile like that. So they're doing really well, 3 and 5 year outperforming. Still making up some of the things. Sometimes people come out of the gate. I hate, you know, you used all any kind of analogies. This guy used all these weird Chinese analogies and other things. I don't even know what he was saying. But anyways, but to cut, you know, sometimes people get out of the gate slow, right? So then they have to make that up later. And that was one, that was with them, SBH, is they got out of the gate a little bit under and they've been making that up over time. Templeton's a manager. You have one international manager. And they, well, you have two international managers. You used to just have one. Templeton, we have two benchmarks for them because what they have is they have international, there's international developed, and then there's international with emerging markets, right? And so they have a mix. So the first benchmark has no emerging markets. The second benchmark has more emerging markets than they have. So it's hard to always sort of see if they're performing well. But if you look at the quarter, they're outperforming the second benchmark, and so I think that's fine for them. Emerging markets had a really tough time. They were beat up. Year to date, they're outperforming that second benchmark. 1 year, they're not doing well on either benchmark, and same with the 3 year. But if you look at the 7 year, and then since inception, they're doing okay. It's just a difficult thing because really the benchmark's in between. But we like them. There's no changes.
So I always question Templeton.
I know you do. Yes. I know you do. But I think that they've done a solid with a 5.4 since 2000, with the international markets being as rocky as they are, a seven and a half years with having that emerging markets. I think that's a good return. I mean, I think, and their management hasn't changed. It's been a stable organization. You know, we like them. Acadian, you know, it was a tough time when you hired them. It was negative for a while. Of course, for the quarter, they're in line with the benchmark. Year to date, they underperformed significantly and the 1 year. This might be somebody to sort of bring in next quarter to just talk to hear. But they're outperforming since inception by a lot, by over a percent. So they've done well. 5 year numbers still strong. 3 year numbers basically in line. So I don't have an issue with them. But they've run into a little bit of difficulty here. The markets have been tough. Fidelity doing well over all periods. They continue to do well for you. And so is DoubleLine doing well over all periods. UBS is your core real estate manager. And core real estate, like I said, is not like that value add and opportunistic. You do give them all the money at once. They're investing it in core properties. You're sort of getting that income. This benchmark is made up of other core funds. So UBS is actually in that benchmark. So is JP Morgan and a few other core funds. So it's not in what we call an investable universe. You couldn't really go buy a benchmark. You can't buy that benchmark. Like, you can't buy an index fund of that. It's, you can't do it. So you sort of have to find a manager that's pretty good at it. You look at their five-year number, you're like, well, that's pretty below there. And then you look at their even 7 and 10 is outperforming. And since inception, it's outperforming. The problem in recent periods, and we've talked about this, and UBS is one maybe we could bring in too. We'll either bring in UBS or Acadian, whichever one you want to bring in next meeting. But this has been a growthy period, a really frothy period. So anybody who has had a lot of leverage, which means a lot of, just a lot of borrowing on their balance sheet, which this tends to be more of a conservative core real estate manager, which we like, they haven't done as well. And so the benchmark is showing better performance because it's factoring in the leverage, right? And so I still think that they're good. We still like them. We recommend them. They actually just came across my desk for another search I was doing the other day. I just think, you know, so it's a tough benchmark to look at. Wellington, you just hired them. Again, talk about coming out of the gate poorly. So Wellington came out of the gate actually okay and then ran into this tough period of time. And if you remember when they presented to you, they talked about India. Mm-hmm. You know, India was one of their major themes. Well, India's run into some problems. They fixed it. India has responded to some of those issues, but that's caused them to have more of a negative turn here. Atos, you heard them. Actually, if you look at them versus the second benchmark there, the HFN benchmark that I talked about before they came in, they're outperforming that over all periods. Now, if you look at them versus the T-bill plus 5, they said T-bill plus 4. It's always been T-bill plus 5. They're under that a little bit. I do think that they're going to protect you, though, as markets get, you know, more. What's been difficult in this market is the S&P has been running. So all your peers who didn't do any diversification, who've just been invested in the S&P 500 and bonds maybe, and mostly S&P 500, have done really, really well, right? Because the S&P has been doing well way past when people thought it would do well. 3 or 4 years ago, people started de-risking out of the S&P 500 thinking it's going to come down. Well, it hadn't. And so your peers in this state who have been more risky, right, and in that have done well, we'll see what they do over the next year or 2 years because that's going to reverse and you can't catch like a falling knife. I mean, for them to get out, they're going to have to you know, scramble, and it's going to hurt to try to move out quickly from that. So overall, you have a solid portfolio. I'm not recommending. Sometimes I would come in and I'd recommend a change and a search. Not recommending any changes or searching. I'm recommending we continue to watch a few managers, and then we'll bring in either UBS or Acadian if anybody has a preference. We might do UBS because I think we talked about that one before, and it's been a longer time. We used to bring managers in every year. You would see every single manager. We decided that really wasn't needed. If they're doing well, it's fine. You don't really need to see them unless you have a question or there's an organizational change. But if they are under their benchmark or if there's questions or concerns, to bring them in and talk to them. So. And that, and then last page 32, is your private managers. Like I said, they're it's just sort of a math thing. The other managers are done a time-weighted return. When you do a manager that basically is taking your money over 3 years as opposed to all at once, you do an IRR that's on the top right, and that's how you calculate their return. And you really only look at that since inception return. And they've all done really well. So these are your real estate managers. They've all done really well. Westport, too, is just so new. Of course, when you're new, you're paying fees on the total amount you've committed to them, but that you've only given them a little bit of money, right? And so you're going to get what they call it in the jargon, they call it a J-curve, right? So basically, you invest here, you know the value is going to go down because they're collecting more fees before the investments actually start working for you. So that's not surprising to see Westport where they are. And then I did pass out my last thing. I passed out this fee chart. It's usually on the back of your book. This just tells you what you pay for fees on all your managers. I just give it to you because as a public pension fund, you're in the public eye a little bit. If anybody says, well, you don't even know what you pay these managers, or you don't know how much this thing costs, and you're paying people millions of dollars to do whatever, you know, at least you know. You say, no, Rose tells us every quarter. And most plans have actually gotten into trouble because they don't know and don't monitor it. Not that it's necessarily been tier or whatever, but as a public plan, you want to say, I know what my fees are, I monitor them, I look at them, Rose is always making sure I get the best fee on a new manager. That's also part of my job, making sure that, and I negotiate fees down whenever I can.
67 basis points.
67 basis points is all in for what you're paying. And if you look at a 401k plan, a 457, you know, y'all are paying way more than 67 basis points on any of your things. I mean, I guess unless you're all index funds, but for active management, you've done well and you outperform. So.
But that doesn't include all of our consultants, actuary, legal, right?
Yeah. But typically, like, even custodian, and I mean, it is usually under, like, 1 or 2 basis points. Like, our fees are pretty, you know, low compared to the money manager fees.
John, that's just fixed overhead.
The sunk cost.
Doing business, right?
So that's my presentation. If anybody has questions.
Nothing? You can ask.
As always, you leave us a speech.
Speech.
What do we think about the housing? I mean, he talked a little bit about it, and I have my own opinions. Are we looking to maybe back off some of the housing, or...
Yeah, I mean, I think that the thing with housing is, so a lot of stuff happened in 2008 where, you know, a lot of that got, and luckily you didn't have any investments that had subprime or any of that kind of thing, which got hit in 2008. The type of investments you have, they're buying these things way below even, like, material costs, building costs, so... They do, and we could bring in a real estate manager to go through it to you, but they stress test them for downturns in the market. And, you know, even with a large downturn in the equity markets, the income that they can produce and things like that are doing well. And they have extensions, right? So if the fund's over, right, if it's to its 10 years or 8 or 9 years in the selling mode, they do have the ability to put an extension in and extend for a couple of years, so they don't have to sell into a bad market, right? So they can hold the properties and wait till the market corrects a little bit. So we still think there's opportunities there. We still think that there's opportunities in real estate. You have to be careful where you find them, but there's opportunities there.
So Doug, what shocks me more than anything is more young people would rather rent apartments than buy houses. They don't want to make that commitment anymore. And I mean, we've heard that through a few of the money managers. It's just, you know, it's different than what we remember life used to be. I mean, things are changing.
So they're moving more away from, like if you heard them talk, they really don't have any malls. They don't have retail because brick and mortar is going away. More people are buying on Amazon, so they're away from that. Even office, they don't have as much office. More apartments, self-storage is coming in there. Things like that, because you're seeing a transient population moving and those kind of opportunities that they're finding. Senior housing, some senior housing things and stuff like that, so.
I've heard Gainesville talk about affordable housing situation they're going through, but I think they're putting it to their county commissioner, city council. And just recently, they're behind Sam's on 200. They're at Canterbury Apartments, and they're going in. They're pretty close to being ready. One of the GCs or somebody there was talking about a lot of attention there from Gainesville residents or area folks. So it looks like we're getting a little bit of that.
Checking those out.
They're a lot cheaper.
There's a lot of people who'd rather commute to Gainesville, even though it's 43 miles, because taxes are lower here. It's just a lower cost of living down here versus up there. They have some issues that they have too many apartments and not enough people renting.
Mm-hmm. And so remember, your real estate is U.S. diversified, right? So you'll have some in the west, you'll have some in the southeast, you'll have some in the northeast, you'll have some midwest, right? So you have what's called an institutional real estate portfolio. So there's nothing probably in Ocala. There's, you know, there may be a little bit in Florida, but in general, they're looking at, a lot of times they're looking at markets like a Boston or a New York, or San Francisco, places that are really constrained where you can't build. Like a place like Tennessee, like where I live, even though Nashville's hot, you know, you can expand out, right? There's not a lot of, Florida and Tennessee are a little similar in that there's not a huge amount of regulation for building, right? You can get permits fairly easily, you can build out. A lot of your real estate managers don't necessarily like that. They want it to be constrained so that, you know, they don't get a competitor right next to them, right? They can figure out, they can do all the math pretty accurately with what the tenant rates will be, how many units will go on board, if they're going to, you know, those kind of things. And so they're looking at markets that are really constrained. And even Texas, they don't always like, because it's sprawling, right? You could go out, and they want it to be constrained so that the people have to stay where they're building their properties, right? And these are billion-dollar funds. You're a small part of a billion-dollar fund. Your money. So.
Is there anything in here about the fund stability with employees retiring, what we're paying out versus what we are generating?
So that's an actuary, more of an actuary thing. When an actuary gives his report, I think he comes once or twice a year, and he goes through all of that. The one thing you can look in here to see sort of inflows and outflows, which is always a good thing to look at, is page 42. And this gives you all your market values over time. So this was a very small fund back in, you know, relatively small fund back in 2000 at $48 million. So the beginning value there. So now you're at $152 million. But the cash flows show you. So do you have money coming out of the fund versus money going in? And actually, you have more money coming into the fund now. That didn't used to be the case. So if you look 2012 through 2016, you actually were taking more money out than was going in. This year, you've had $3.7 million coming in, basically, from employees in the city, and just goes through that. And then you've had gains of $2.6 million from your investments. So from my investment perspective, that's healthy. From your funding rate and what you're funded and that's a different thing. And the actuary goes through what your funded percentage is and how much money you have to put in and those kind of things.
So it used to be our actuary would give a percentage of what the city would have to contribute. And we all agreed to move that to a dollar amount. And then this year, October 1st, everything changed again because the city gave a lump sum for the year, which is not what we were used to. So all of a sudden, Rose had to go find somewhere to go stash $15 million because the city just gave it all at once.
Which is better for you financially, but
yes,
I don't know why we increased the $3 million, $8 million, is that where that money came from?
No, we had some money that, you know, from $4 million to $8 million. We already have all the percentages that we want to, given the different factors of how we want to risk our money and what we're looking for investment and return. It's just the city knew a dollar amount that they had to contribute, and they'd rather just give it all up front and not have to worry about every month giving it in and what they should be giving in, so they just took the number. So a lot of things have changed for the city. When they froze the existing pension plan, a bunch of people jumped ship and they didn't plan on that, which, I mean, Doug, you get to see that because of where you are with the payroll money and all, but how much has gone into the pension plan? I mean, you know, it's the older people like us, I mean, they're giving 100% of payroll into the pension. Actually, I think it's 102%. But, I mean, those numbers were not expected. Now, eventually, you know, kind of like you heard, people die off and slowly, you know. I look at the numbers every month when Jessica does payroll, how much we're paying out versus what's coming in. And we used to be at like $750,000 going out every month, and now we're closer to $1 million every month going out. But when they still gave $15 million, you know, just by giving quick numbers, you know we're still on the positive side. The city's giving more than what's being paid out. And then there's all about your fiduciary responsibility to the plan to make sure you're earning interest to make it stable. So I know we went through this a long time ago when they froze the plan, but, and I went around telling people, you voted me in to deal with the fiduciary responsibility to the plan, not to the employees. You're not an employee representative. You're really here. They voted you in with confidence that you're going to look at the plan, working with Rose, to make sure that the investments are where they need to be, and looking where somebody isn't performing and some putting them on call or actually getting rid of them, getting someone else.
So again, it's kind of like the hedge fund, where it's that overall performance of the entire fund, where you guys are putting out the percentages, and if a certain percentage isn't meeting that area, it needs to be addressed.
Yes.
And so what I do on a 3 to 5 year basis is I do what's called an asset allocation study, and I did one more recently, and that goes through, you have 14% in equity, you know, whatever percent in international equity. I do all the buckets for you, and then I give you different mixes. I say mix 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and you could see what they would give you for a return over the long run, like a 7% return over the long run, and then how much risk you're willing to take, right? And so you get to choose what those targets are, and that's what this board has done. So you're basically, and the policy says you have to be fully invested at all time. So even if we get $50 million, and as like we can't keep it in cash. The policy says it has to be fully invested. So whatever your targets are, if I see a place where you're under or a place where you're over, I'll put the money where you're under allocated, right, and allocate that money across there. And then like your real estate money, if they haven't called the money yet, that money's fully invested in your other stuff. And then as they call the money, I'll just recommend a place for you to liquidate money, right? So if you're over in U.S. equity, we'll liquidate a little bit of money to fund that real estate, right? And that's how you sort of always are rebalancing a little bit over time as you need money for different investments. Does that sort of make sense?
So for no extended period of time, do we have cash?
Exactly. That's right.
We make sure there's enough to pay payroll every month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there has been once or twice, you know, that somebody left the drop and we need a little bit more money, and Alicia will reach out to Rose and say, where do I steal $500,000 from? And that's the whole thing of it always being liquid, that we have to understand, you know, certain ones we just can't drag money from, other ones we can, and that's...
And usually it's 2 or 3 days. I can get money from most anybody 2 or 3 days, so it's
and
fine.
And you're looking at the longer term, somebody give you another, more notice in 2 or 3 days.
So right. Do that, yeah. And, you know, one of the things that I do on the side is I look at how many people are still in the drop, how much money, you know, is actually owed by to all these people in the drop when they want to leave, and how much is needed, and whoever becomes the chair is familiar with those numbers. I mean, just so you're familiar with it, but Rose and Alicia take care of all that. That is just, you know, it's very fluid and it just works.
Are we limited to not investing locally, or is it just, I mean, I know the city has its own bonds that it pulls out for different projects as well. Are we limited from investing in our own city bonds?
Maybe a conflict of interest if we just
you...
Invested in ourselves?
That's sort of an economically targeted investment.
Yeah.
We fail, we fail.
If you're going to do that, you've got to do the analysis, and it's got to be comparable to other investments on a risk and return basis.
And you can't invest, like, you can't just invest in one bond, like, you can't invest in, you have to have a manager that's that, each of these investment managers, so I'm a fiduciary, which means I sit at the table like you, if I have to give you advice that is to the benefit of the plan, right? Can't benefit me or anybody else.
Or the city.
Or the city, but I have to give you the best advice that's the benefit of the plan, and that's on my, like, as a fiduciary, that's my goal. Your money managers are also fiduciaries for the money that they manage for you, which means that they have to manage it in a specific way, not to lose money, they have to whatever. If you just invested in one bond, you know, you don't have somebody taking responsibility for that investment, right? I'm not taking responsibility. You're not taking responsibility. You have to have an actual money manager that's taking responsibility to know when to buy it, when to sell it, how to make money off it. You know what I mean? So you can't really just buy individual. Like, you couldn't buy a property. Like, you couldn't own this building. You can't own that. What you own for properties is within a fund, an institutional diversified fund, with a manager who is an expert in that asset class that I've identified for you. It's recommended by us that is taking the responsibility to know when to buy the properties, when to sell them, making sure it's diversified, risk is, you know, taken into effect, all those kind of things. So you can't just buy, you know, one hotel, or you can't just buy, you know, you can't do those
things. Yeah, I would never want to buy stock, you know, any bonds in Detroit. I mean...
Yeah, you can't buy one stock or one bond or anything like that. You have to have a manager who's managing that for you, who's an expert.
So yeah, it's checks and balances for every one of these money managers. They have to be.
And they have E&O insurance. They have all kinds of, you know, things that they have to check off the box to be able to manage your money.
Do you work for the board or the, you said your responsibility is to the plan?
To the general board. The general board pays me. So I...
Not the city, not council. Mm-hmm.
No.
So there's money in the pension fund that's allocated for certain things, like for paying these particular people that help us. Lee, our attorney, Rose, our advisor. Everybody gets some extra education. In fact, you're required every year to get some additional education, so you stay on top of things. I did the 3 years at the Florida pension, and then I moved on to talk to some of the money managers. I've gone to Franklin Templeton. I go to Siegel to see how they do their research and talk to them about, you know, those kind of things. And that's still continued education. Every once in a great while, we bring Lee in to give you all something about the Sunshine Act, which you have to understand that. Understand, like, the two of you can't talk together without being in this recorded meeting about something that might be voted upon, and understand the consequences if you do and if you get caught. Nobody wants to serve time or pay a huge fee, and it's both of those, depending on the fact, you know.
And what I learned early with regard to emails, you know, how easy it is when you get an email and it's addressed to 15 people and it's coming from the administrator of the plan. Okay, which is the finance department that we contract out, Jessica and Alicia, and she's sending it to everybody, and then you want to respond by hitting reply all. Well, you don't do that. You just reply to Alicia, because it's not a
public
meeting like we are. So those, you'll catch on.
You can talk to me, though, so if you have any questions off, you can talk to me. You can't talk to me to talk to him, but you can talk to me, and just any questions you have, I'll give you my cards. You can always call me. You get the book ahead of time. I try to send the book at least a week ahead of time, so if you want to read it, you have questions before a meeting, you can always call me. You go to a conference, you meet a manager, you meet somebody who tells you something, or you sit in on a thing and you don't really understand it, call me. I'm actually teaching at FPPTA in February, so if you're happy to be there, I'll be there at FPPTA. So just
some of these money managers will come up and try to solicit you and blow a lot of smoke up there, and you still have to come back to Rose, and she'll give you her opinion of that particular person. And it comes through a full research group, it's not just her. And that's the bigger thing to understand, that she's got a lot of backing behind her with a lot of people who research stuff, so.
Yeah, we're about 120 people, so it's a pretty big organization.
And also with regard to some of our fixed costs, like the administration, like Alicia and like Jessica, we could be doing that outside. We could be hiring a private company to administer the plan. Or an individual, but we utilize the city employees on a kind of cost-sharing basis, and that's how we do the internal administration.
So that's one of the fees, is actually paying payroll for Jessica and Alicia. OPD, their pension plan, pays a percentage of it, and so does fire.
And so each pension fund does it differently, like Cape Coral General, which I, you know, work for, they have an outside administrator, so they don't use the city at all. They have an outside person administer their fire, their police, and their general. But like Tallahassee does internal like you do it. So everybody does it a little bit differently.
So to me personally, if I send any of you to Jessica, she can give you real answers. And she's within a couple percent when she gives you a guesstimation of a number you're looking at when you want to retire. Whereas if we subbed all this to an outside, not only do you have to make an appointment, you got to go somewhere and meet somebody, you don't get that face-to-face, you don't feel that confidence that, you know, it's... we've kind of changed a few things around that administration-wise, they report to Jared just for who's taking PTO and who's calling sick, only because otherwise it would have to come to the chairman or something else, so we just simplified that they're here, it just makes sense. That Jared kind of oversees it. Remember, they're dealing with financial stuff. So, I mean, it makes sense that they're kind of up here and they're dealing with personnel, they're dealing with financial. So, in my mind, there's a benefit to the employee of having them in-house versus subbing it all out. Now, you probably save a little bit by subbing it out, but you're going to lose a lot, in my mind, a lot.
And you've experienced a lot recently, right?
Well, so, yeah, and the experience is something else. You know, Alicia is getting on the countdown, and Jessica is learning as fast as she can. She's trying to work on a degree, and she's a mother raising a child, so getting out to go into school is definitely a burden, but she's working on it. And I've beat up on her several times with her PR and all, that she's got certain things to meet. So there's a lot going on. I mean, it's...
What responsibilities do we have with the 401A, with the fund?
Nothing. City's running the 401A. We do none of the investment. We do none of... So like I had a question Rodney asked me Thursday. He called me that some of the newer groundmen and apprentices, they're in the 401A, and they want to know that when they reach their 30 years, can they start collecting and still come back and work for the city? And I said, well, that I don't know. I don't think you can, but they told me someone in HR told them that they can. And I don't know all those rules. So those are certain things that I told them I would come ask a few people, like Leo, probably going to ask him before he bugs out, if they can do that stuff. Because I don't know the rules of a 401A.
Who do we refer them to? Just HR?
Yeah.
For that?
Yeah, the city's picked that plan, and they're managing it.
Right.
We are.
Okay.
The other thing that you all have to be cognizant about, Alicia and Jessica are slowly picking up more and more work from the fire pension because they really don't have anybody running it anymore. OPD, we have a couple older people that are probably close to retiring like me that have been active, and we don't know what's going to go on with them. Dale just won't commit if he's leaving or not, but we know that, you know, Randy left the fire department, and he tried his hardest to try to get some people in here to start learning, to mentor them, and he's out in Africa somewhere now, backpacking.
Okay.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to be a part of this. That's why I kind of got involved in having a vested interest in seeing it be profitable and long-lasting, especially after things that have happened in the city.
Gotta last till the last man dies, right? mean, that's really the bottom line. You know I'm kind of blunt. You've known me for a long time.
Yes.
But that's really it. You just want to keep it stable, and that's part of what we're all doing. I mean, we thank Johnny and Bernie all the time because they're just outside citizens sitting in here helping us make decisions just to keep kind of things balanced. Anthony, of course, is on the verge of both sides. I mean, he's been, you know, brought in from council, but he's an employee, but he's a firefighter, so he doesn't deal with the general. But he's learning it all, so, you know, if they dump fire on him, he at least would have a knowledge of how to step in and do it. And maybe that's their hidden plans, I don't know. Otherwise, it's going to be Jessica and Alicia to deal with that piece, too. Well, any more questions, or let's move on to Lee and see what we got.
Okay, well, I'll pick up on some of what we were talking about. When did you guys become official?
February, I think we will.
February meeting, they'll officially be here.
This coming.
Taking seats, yeah.
Okay, the reason I ask if it was this year, then as a new trustee, you need to file within 30 days. In your cases, you'll need to file February as the date, your form F-1 financial disclosure with the supervisor of elections in the county you reside in within 30 days. Once you're on the board and all the other trustees, you need to file by July 1st each year. And Arnie, when is your official last day?
January 30th. So in January, I'll do my closeout.
Okay, so you'll need to do two disclosures then. You'll need to do the Form 1 by July 1, and you'll also need to do the 1F final disclosure within 60 days of your last day.
Right. Doug, Rob, if you want to come by my office, I'll show you what the form looks like. It's very easy to fill
out. This is Sunshine Law that we're talking about.
Yeah, and fines were mentioned earlier. The Ethics Commission oversees these, and they don't have any sense of humor about the time frames. And there's actually fines that for late filing, and so you want to be sure to do that. And I always do reminders on that. Also, you guys, if you ever have any questions, you're welcome to call. We can talk. As Rose said, as trustees, you cannot communicate with another trustee outside of a meeting such as we're having today that's been noticed and minutes are being kept. But you can talk to a third party. But also, as Rose said, so long as you're not used as a conduit to another trustee. So we're happy. And over the years, I've done a lot of conferences. I've done some materials on trustee responsibilities. I don't know if there's probably some around here that might be helpful for you. If you're interested, you could send those to you. In fact, I just did that. About a month ago, the Division of Retirement sponsors two conferences a year, and the last was about a month ago, and the first day is always designated to be a new trustee school. And I did that this year, and the basic outline for that, if you're interested, I'll send them.
Yes, sir.
Did you all get this from, so, you know, the city's attorney gives an ethics class. Every couple of years. I mean, it doesn't seem to do it every year, but
it was a couple of months ago.
Yeah, and there's boards from all over that deal with the Sunshine Act, and yeah. I'm just, you know, he just goes through the ethics to try to explain stuff. So you really got to keep your mouth shut before you can talk. And because of the Sunshine Act in Florida.
Has to be a reported meeting. It has to be a reported meeting.
Well, if it's two board members, it can affect a vote or something that's, you know, like, yeah.
Minutes have to be kept. It doesn't need to be.
And it has to be announced that there's a meeting and public is invited.
And then the form.
Like I said, if you want to come by, I'll show you what the form looks like. And it's super, super easy to fill out. And just trying to look that you don't have any money invested personally.
There's really no, unlike a loan application or something, there's not dollar amounts, it's categories of assets that you have.
Oh, okay.
So, if your official day will be February, then two things, the board will need to under its rules, certify the election results. You were both elected, I believe, correct?
Yeah, the only two that ran, the only two that got voted in.
Okay, so they ruined my acclamation.
Right.
Every now and then, it's always the default. I said acclamation. So, and there's a few, the legislative session, I've got a few updates today, and I think we'll have more to talk about in upcoming meetings. The legislative session next year begins in March, first week in March, and always goes 60 days. So we've got that to look forward to. And now, bills are starting to be pre-filed and assigned to committees for discussion. So I'll keep you updated and posted on what, if anything, is pending that could affect us. We've been fortunate the last few years in that we've come out pretty much unscathed from the legislature. It wasn't always that way. I'd say the last thing was a few years ago, and Rose mentioned when we were mandated to use a particular mortality table, same one as FRS uses, and that increased the cost in a lot of ways. But so I'll keep you posted on that. Also, I'm currently working on internal revenue updates to our ordinance, most recent of which is guidance that we got from the IRS recently that tells us what we need to do if we have a retiree or a beneficiary that's in pay status and we can't find them. And other specific steps we have to take in order to not affect our plan qualification. And I'm laying those out step by step, just as it's in the IRS notice, in our rules, and as referenced in the ordinance, but not in the detail we have in our rules. Meanwhile, this is in effect now. So if we have that situation, even if it's before you adopt the new rules or the city adopts a new ordinance, we still can comply with the IRS guidance on that.
So today we have a hook into the Social Security to find out if somebody is deceased. Do we still do the Are You Alive letters? I don't think we do them anymore now that we tie it into Social Security.
Yeah, we just run a report at the end of every month. And then it gets, you know, if somebody has passed, it'll show me their full Social Security number. And then that way I can contact their beneficiary, family member, if there's a benefit that should be continued to pay.
Yeah,
we sent a memorandum on this, and it does happen still from time to time. Most frequently, I would say it's a situation where we may have a person in pay status that's living with somebody else. They're deceased, but the checks continue, and somebody else cashes the checks. We want to avoid that because it's not always easy to get the money back, and it's time and expense involved with that. Another situation we see arise from time to time is with respect to an optional form of benefit. Sometimes, depending on the option somebody chooses, it will change the payment amount and that they're entitled to, but the actual pay amount is not changed. That's what sometimes we run into as well. So, now, the missing persons directive from the IRS. That's important because if we're ever examined by the IRS, that's a qualification issue. And if we don't have these, follow their guidelines, then we could have a plan disqualified, which would be catastrophic. That's something we never want to happen. So that's that. And that's really it for today, and I will keep you posted on what we're seeing in Tallahassee. And you, again, you're welcome to call me. Arnie calls me from time to time.
So nothing really good to report, huh?
And Lee, I'm sorry,
Lee,
you had called me and I didn't call you back, and I'm sorry I didn't call you back, but I didn't call you back because, you know, I didn't care about those people. The doing people you had called me about, you know, I know
I had to go through an awful lot to people I didn't care about.
Well, I did care about them once they had the position they did. I knew it wasn't going to really go anywhere, so.
Yeah. Yeah, because you know what's wrong, well, yeah.
All right, minutes, you get to read them? Can we have a motion to accept them?
Make a motion to accept the minutes.
Second it, all in favor?
Aye.
Awesome. Amendment six. Jessica?
We go back to Lee on that?
Yeah.
Judicial deference to hearing officer decision, what? Constitutional Amendment six, that was part of it?
Yeah, we...
Got to bring that one, right?
Yeah, it's nothing, it's going to change anything that we're doing. Our legal proceedings are quasi-judicial. If the board ever has a need at a hearing or anything.
So it looks like elect a chairperson, a vice chair, and a secretary. Not everybody's in the pot right now to do that, right? So you probably got to put that off to next meeting.
Yeah, February meeting.
Right. Jessica, you want to talk about this Milliman or?
I did find the prices for you. The initial fee for setup, the one-month fee is $30,000, and then the month or the yearly would be $3,700.
$3,700? Oh, that's cheap.
And I'll be split between the three boards, maybe the city as well, so it could be a fourth of it. It's basically for retention. We need a system that's not going to change. The city's been changing systems every 10 years, and they only pull in 3 to 5 years worth of information. So if we lose, you know, the wages for somebody who's going to start drawing in 2043, that information can be gone. So we're trying to find something that is going to keep everybody's information in one area for pension. Hopefully we won't have that issue. The city, once I'm in IT, she's trying to get with the city to, you know, get them rolling and see what they can do with payment and so forth.
What kind of program do we use currently? Just not spreadsheets and stuff?
We do our own spreadsheets, but like with Eden, the financial system, and then we're moving to Munis. There is, you know, so much information that gets stored in there. But like I said, once they move from Eden, Eden's going to go away. They're only going to pull 3 years actually into Munis.
Oh, wow.
So we're, that's why they want to get a Pacific pension. That way everything's going to be in there hopefully forever. The next person who comes along to keep track of everything is going to know.
And this is a program specifically designed to do that.
Yes.
Right.
How did we come to Milliman, which I know is a fairly big outfit in pension administration?
I believe that IT actually contacted Milliman. We tried this about 2 years ago, I think. I contacted them and tried to get some more information. Some of the boards weren't really interested at the time, so we're bringing it back up. I know that Winsome down in IT, she's really pushing for this for us. She's not this issue anymore, so she's going to go directly to the city. But we want to make sure that the pension boards are going to, you know, be on board as well. I am going to contact three cities, Fort Lauderdale. I'm not sure the other two, they are in that packet, but I'm going to contact them and get research on how it's working for them. You know, what modules that they actually got and so forth, and I'm going to bring that to the February meeting.
Are there other purveyors out there? Did we look at any others besides Milliman?
Not that I'm aware of. Since I've been here 3 years, this is the one that we've been kind of pushing for. So
there's a couple other things at $37,000. Any of the city managers can sign that. That's a one-time expense. And what she's saying is that the recurring is fairly low for the retention, but I've been here long enough to see several times where software changes and the conversions don't work properly, and they say, well, we'll keep the server up so at least we can get the data off of it, and the next thing you know, the server's shut down and all that data's lost.
Yeah.
So the city, you know, is, the three pension boards offered to pay up to $200,000 for a software module to go in the munis for pension, because it's always an issue when we try to pull the numbers together to give the actuary the numbers he needs. There's a lot of floating numbers when you think of how many people are retired and how many people are still working and what their age is and how much are they earning and if they got promoted and if there's raises, and you got to keep track of all those numbers. And I can't wait for you all to sit and talk to Doug, an actuary. You know, he's got a big old crystal ball trying to figure out numbers. And I mean, you heard me mention mortality. Well, that's a death rate. I mean, any way you look at it, and that's a number that you use for some of the calculations. How long is someone going to live?
He'll be the first to tell you that usually it's pretty cloudy in that crystal ball.
Very cloudy. But you depend on somebody for that kind of information. Then I have lots of heartburns that, you know, that the CAFRs don't come out until March, and you really don't really have all the numbers until the CAFRs come out when everything's solidified, that all the CPAs and all the firm blessed numbers and their actual. And so there's a lot of little things that go on the financial side that we don't have a package for. So Alicia goes and pulls these numbers and sends them off to the actuary, and he'll say, no, they're not right, you need to get these numbers. And that's why we've asked for the modules to sit in our financial piece to just kick those numbers out for pension. And all I heard, it was horrifying that they had one person sit with Alicia. Was it you two? And she dealt with like 15 people. 15 people that are in a pension plan. Not really much experience with the munis stuff, so that's scary. So it'll probably still be the old-fashioned way of crunching numbers, trying to get them out. And then we did report cards. We did you get some more responses?
I missed two.
So we're one of the things I tried to initiate is doing PERs on everybody who performs services for us, that we can evaluate them, assess them, and give them some goals if they're not meeting our expectations. And Jessica sent them out, but we didn't get a complete return on them. So I guess you can deal with that in February. Well, you know, bottom line, and you hear me take the stance all the time, we spend money. Let's hold people accountable for what we're spending the money on. If they're not performing up to our expectations, then we owe it to them to sit down with them, tell them what they're not meeting of our expectations. And if they still can't meet it, then we need to move on and go get someone else. I mean, you know, you're spending money out of the fund. Make sure that you're spending it wisely.
Have the various actuaries that do the service for the various city pensions been plugged in development?
I'm not sure. I can get that answered for you.
But I would think would be something that needs to be considered.
When's the next scheduled meeting with the actuary? The next meeting? So,
he'll probably be our February meeting.
Why, thank you.
Your fiscal year for all plans in Florida is fiscal September, so this quarter, September, was your fiscal. And so the actuary needs a certain amount of time after your fiscal year ends to give you the next report. So I would think February, but you've had trouble getting whatever.
Well, so you know I feed up on Doug. I mean, you know, so one of his stances that he took was we have two pension plans. We have the defined and then the variable defined. And he has to give it actually report on both of them combined and individually. And he used to use that as an excuse, but I've told him now that he's worked this long enough that he should have his act together. And he, the last report came in a timely manner.
So, I mean, it does take a little while to collect all the data and get everything from September 30th till whenever he puts this report together, but I would think by February you can have your X-ray report.
Exactly. How long should it take? And I'd be happy to call him before Christmas just to remind him he's got some dues in February.
But of course, in defense of the X-rays, I mean, they have everybody's reports. Of course, he works in the state of Florida, so everybody's due at the exact same time.
Yeah, he may not ever all due, but of course, then he's got some work he has to pick out for all the people that he works for. But he works for us too, right? He just recently did an experience study. You want to explain what an experience study is, Rose?
Oh, I don't know. I'm an X-ray expert, but I don't, you know. So experience study, just usually you do them every 5 years or so, plans have to do them. And Doug would explain it way better than me. Never been an X-ray. But you're just taking all of your numbers and seeing if they make sense, right? So they'll look at mortality. Did as many people die as you thought were going to die? Did more die? Did less die? Were raises as much as you thought they would be, right? Because all those factor into how much you're going to pay somebody at the end. So did people get a 2% raise, 3% raise, only a 1% raise? So he has all these assumptions that he has for, you know, raises people are going to get, new employees that you'll have, like did you hire this many new over the last 10-year period or did you hire whatever? So he's just seeing if your experience matches his assumptions. Because he's making assumptions all the time of, you know, how many people you're going to die, how many people. You're a closed plan, so he doesn't have to have any assumption as new people added, but, you know, did people retire when he thought they were going to? You know, I think he has an assumption on how many people are going to take an early versus a what, like all those assumptions. Yeah. Missing some?
No, I just need to interrupt you. The computer's about to reboot in a minute, so I want to close out our meeting because we're really done. And what Rose is talking about really is not needed to be recorded. So I'm going to adjourn our meeting, unless anybody has anything else.
I just want to reiterate something I did mention in our last meeting, so there's no confusion. The fire and police plans, pursuant to statute, are required to do a budget each year and file with the city a report of expenses for the last fiscal year and an itemization of each investment. We are not required to do that. We can do it, but we're not required. So if there's talk about it, and we wonder, gee, we should be doing that too, the answer is no.
Awesome. Motion to adjourn?
I move.
All right. Yeah, we all agree.